Hello there, this is Mark Bauerlein for another conversation. In September 2015, an essay appeared in The Atlantic magazine with the title The Coddling of the American Mind. It had a subheading that read, "In the name of emotional well-being, college students are increasingly demanding protection from words and ideas they don't like. Here's why that's disastrous for education and mental health." It turned out to be one of those essays that, it triggered a huge response. It somehow caught a sensitive point in American life. Everyone read it. Everyone talked about it. Everyone debated it, not just in education, higher education circles, but in the broad intellectual world as well. The two authors of that essay, they were co-authored, Greg Lukianoff and Jonathan Haidt. They co-authored it. Greg Lukianoff, he's the president and CEO of the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, FIRE. He's a graduate of American University, Stanford Law School, specialist in free speech and First Amendment issues in higher education. His previous book, which I read and enjoyed, was Unlearning Liberty, Campus Censorship and the End of American Debate, and also Freedom from Speech. Co-author Jonathan Haidt is the Thomas Cooley Professor of Ethical Leadership at NYU's Stern School of Business. He's a social psychologist, doctorate from University of Pennsylvania, and he taught at the University of Virginia for several years, author most prominently of a book, The Righteous Mind. The two men produced a book under the same title. It came out last year, The Coddling of the American Mind, same title. The subtitle was How Good Intentions and Bad Ideas Are Setting Up a Generation for Failure. And the paperback has just come out, the book. It sold so doggone well in hardback that the paperback, and Greg Lukianoff is here to join us to discuss the book, who just told me that the paperback just came out and it was right up there on the New York Times paperback bestseller list. Mr. Lukianoff, Lawyer Lukianoff, Director Lukianoff, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
Okay, let's go right to the book. The start, The Coddling of the American Mind. I think that word coddling was a stroke of genius. We go from the closing of the American mind, now we have the coddling of the American mind, which in some ways is worse. Who picked that word?
That was actually The Atlantic that picked coddling, and I objected. And as you may know, Mark, I actually objected to it, and I've been very public in objecting to it. Not partially because it tends to get misunderstood as simply spoiling, that essentially, like, these are spoiled brats and blah blah blah, and that's not precisely what we're saying. But at the same time, my preferred title for the article was the incredibly boring arguing towards misery, which is basically saying that more or less some of the intellectual habits we're teaching in higher education are going to make people not just illiberal, it's going to make them anxious and depressed. And that came a lot truer than we ever thought in a million years. And for the book, what we went into doing the book, I was like, no, we're not going to call it Coddling the American Mind again. Because partially we also get that thing where people think we're just retreading Alan Bloom's stuff. And, you know, it's a phenomenal and extremely interesting and very deep book, but there's not that much similarity between our book and theirs. And I wanted to call the book Disempowered, which I thought was a little less boring, because I wanted one thing that I'm always trying to do is not to preach to the choir. Of course you want to talk to the choir somewhat.
we've got enough preaching to the choir. What a bore.
Yeah, and so. I think it was Anne Applebaum of someone wrote a blurb for it saying that the title's unfortunate because that means it won't be read by some of the people who most desperately need to read it. The good news is, for the most part, I am finding that people who would be your sort of typical suspects, the people that you would think might be turned off by the title, have been reading it. And in some cases, of course, they hate it. But in other cases, I get emails and tweets very often from people who came in skeptical and were like, huh, it really seems like we've messed things up here.
Well, I would say that it would seem to appeal to the deans of student life at college campuses, or even people at the clinic, who are saying, listen, whatever your intentions, what you have been doing, which we will put under the word coddling, and I'll ask you to specify what are some of the things that they have been doing. These are making problems that you face all the time worse. You talk about one phenomenon, and you give a couple of examples of it in the book, of a student, and you know, students go to college, 18, 19 years old, they're away from their homes for the first time in their lives, they're meeting new people, and they're going through all kinds of things, the pressures of school, and they end up going into counseling, over to the counseling, student health service for counseling. They walk in, they're feeling anxious and nervous or depressed, and they walk out, and all of the problems they have are aggravated. These sessions do not make them feel better. They make them feel worse. The very problems that they're out to lighten, to assuage, are, again, intensified. So that, just on a practical level, the way in which you're treating students in this, I don't know if you want to call it a sensitivity condition, this is not working for you.
Right. Well, when it comes to the mental health centers, I do think there are a lot of people in there who do actually help with student psychological issues. What I think that's actually making it worse is an environment that's in parenting, that's in K-12, and with particular focus in the first article, coming from higher education, that's more or less lying to students, saying, listen, by the way, you're fragile. Your friends are fragile. If you hear things that bother you, you could be traumatized by it. And once you're traumatized, that's a core part of your identity, and you're stuck with it forever, and there's really nothing we can do to help you. And I explain this like on campus after campus, and it's interesting to watch people still have the instinct on campus of being like, oh my God, then we need to do more to protect them. And it's like, no, you're doing precisely the wrong thing, because there's this concept of internal locus of control. It's a term that I'm sure a lot of listeners will be familiar with, but it's basically just the idea that you have some control over your own life. And I think that the sort of model of what life looks like that we're selling on campus, particularly in orientations and among administrators, is this incredibly disempowered, you know, you're both oppressed and oppressor, your identity, you're at least partially evil. You're easily traumatized. Words can harm you. Everybody who disagrees with you is evil. It's a really sort of unpleasant worldview to be in, and no wonder it makes people incredibly anxious and depressed.
Is this what you mean in the first section? You have three bad ideas, and the first one is the untruth of fragility.
Oh yeah, absolutely. The untruth of fragility. So basically, like, there was a point that I give you a little insight into the process for writing the book. John is incredible to work with. It's just absolutely spectacular. I had a great team at FIRE, including people like Pamela Presky and Adam Goldstein, helping out. But there was a point at which we were getting so deeply into some of the ideology on campus and trying to sort of parse through it. I said a couple times, I'm like, we're starting to write a book that I don't want to read. And so we took a step back and thought about like what were we really saying in the original article. And more or less, we were giving what my family does, which is negative advice, basically saying like, okay, I'm not going to tell you what you should do, but I'm going to tell you what the worst possible thing you could do is. So we open up the book by talking about these things we call the great untruths. The first one is, and we set it up as a guru giving us awful advice and us being like horrified at it. A great untruth number one is what doesn't kill you makes you weaker, which is of course a play on Nietzsche. And basically what we're saying is it's as if campuses have people come there, and rather than talking up to them and saying you're resilient, they're saying you're not resilient, you can't handle it, and you're easily damaged forever. And that's malpractice. That's a horrible thing to teach people.
Well, I'll say that, you know, last semester when I was at Emory University, where I've been teaching for a long time, it's actually a great place to work. But I did walk through the library during finals week, and they did have a room set aside with puppies. The puppies were there.
You know, I should say I am pro puppy, and it's hard to it just sounds mean to sort of be against this. But I remember when that Judith Shulevitz article came out in the New York Times talking about how Brown had a debate between two feminists about rape culture, and they set up this safe room that had puppies and cookies and all this kind of stuff. And even for me, who at that point had already been working in the campus sort of culture war battles for a good 12 years, I was like, you gotta be kidding me. And I think to the students themselves, like, what's the harm here? The harm is that you're convincing yourself that you're fragile children.
That's the implicit message. I mean, I like puppies too. Puppies are wonderful. They're soft. They're nice to play with. But what you're saying is this is finals week. This is the culmination of 14 weeks of study. This is where you demonstrate what you've learned. This is where the experience reaches its ultimate test. And you're turning that from a kind of realization of what you've been working on for 14, 15 weeks into a very hazardous, risky situation. It's a threshold in which you need help. And again, it's the implicit, you use the word disempowering. And I think that's the dangerous thing, not puppies, but again, what you're contrasting that with in terms of, no, here you go. The exam is coming. You're going to work 3 hours on this, and it converts the experience into something else. That one thing you say in your subtitle of the book, you're setting up a generation for failure. Because when you're in the workplace, there aren't going to be any puppies.
But here I've been hearing that won't this be a rude awakening to students when they show up at work? For my entire career, when it was more focused on strictly the sort of the free speech aspect of it, and my position has always been no. If there's enough of them, they're going to change the way work looks. And one of the things that both John and I are running into a lot, and of course it's usually with a caveat, you can't say what company. But is that as the generation is entering the workforce, a lot of these kind of dysfunctional, untruth beliefs that they have are still present. And one of the things that I am hearing about are organizations that are more or less paralyzed by internal interpersonal drama, that whereas it used to be handled by one-on-one interaction and people hashing out their differences, that given the sort of intermediated experience that all of these students have had their entire life, they're going to human resources and demanding that, Jerry has to go because he microaggressed me. And that it ends up being this dysfunctional. And my two predictions are, my one stock tip is invest in HR companies. If you can buy stock in them, absolutely do. But I'm willing to bet that there are companies that are going to go down due to some of these dynamics that I'm hearing about in the generation currently coming out of elite colleges. Now, what I think a positive result of that could be is maybe at least for a while, people go, wow, I don't really want to hire anybody from Brown. I don't really want to hire anybody from some of these elite schools. Maybe we should place less emphasis on that and hire smart people, hardworking people from state schools instead.
Well, my wife's father runs a very large law firm. He told me a while ago that they actually decided to stop hiring people directly out of law school. They wanted to wait a few years, go in the workplace, spend some time getting paychecks, getting away from the campus environment, then we will hire you. And that was a decision made solely, again, on practical grounds. Look, these human resources issues can be very expensive. And I actually had another man tell me he works in a software company in the Midwest, and then he said in just in the last few years he's realized that when there's a big meeting and the very top figures, when the human resources vice president comes in the room, you know who the real king is in the internal workings of the company. Human resources is extremely powerful. Perhaps that's because the federal government has given human resources a heck of a lot of power on things. And, again, it's a big COB, right?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
And I imagine college campuses, I mean, the machinery, especially at the selective private schools, the machinery of safety nets, of sort of the protective mechanisms and all the people working on that, that's got to be a major part of the college costs.
And that's something that we try to explain, this kind of this intermediated life that we're talking about is very different than the way, certainly I grew up with, surely the way you did too, where pretty much from all the way through college and beyond, there's always been sort of an authority figure that you're encouraged to sort of handle disputes, handle any difficulty, give you advice, all this kind of stuff. And that's not just harmful for like the ultimate sort of like sense of autonomy and internal locus of control, all these mental health and independence ideas. Honestly, I think this is a long-term problem for our democracy. If you're raising people who even up into their early 20s are used to quote unquote adults handling conflicts for you, that's not raising people to live as free citizens in a free society. That's raising them to actually welcome Big Brother.
You may have said this or someone else. Look, in a democratic society, you've got to have a little bit of a thicker skin. You can't have people walking around offended all the time. And I'm gonna.
I've done this before, and if I'm feeling especially when I'm feeling, I try to be as charitable and open-minded and win people over as much as I can, but sometimes I do get frustrated. And when I hear sometimes people talking about this need to be protected from, every kind of abrasion of everyday life, I'm like, okay, well then maybe freedom isn't for you. maybe that old czarist trope that the peasants have the greatest freedom of all, which is the freedom from the pressures of rule, which I always thought sounded, nightmarish. When you start hearing people that can't deal with interpersonal conflicts and think that someone power is rule to interfere with that, it's like that's not the kind of attitude you need to be able to live as what's supposed to be at least a citizen who's part of a sovereign government.
Right, and this especially applies in the college campus where you have just this intense devotion to the free exchange of ideas, the willingness to entertain hypotheses that may at first strike you as, hey, that's wrong, that's off. And I'm going to give an example that you raise in the book and get your explanation of it. There was an article that came out in 2010 in the journal Hypatia, a journal of feminist philosophy. And the article essentially argued that we've got a little bit of a double standard when we look at transsexual or transgender versus transracial. We're very open and affirmative here in academia about, men who transition or women, the sexual transitions, but the racial transition, the famous example of this Rachel Dolezal, who was in the NAACP. She claimed she was black, but she's really born white. But she actually had completely adopted an African American identity. And the article was simply raising the consideration of what this double standard means. And here is your and Jonathan's comment on this. Within a few weeks of its publication, the article had generated such an uproar that an open letter was published addressed to the editor of Hypatia and, quote, the broader Hypatia community. The letter demanded that the article be retracted, not rebutted, but retracted. You italicize that. You have then on the next page a heading, a section called Retraction is the New Rebuttal. First, if you want to comment on the specific case, and then the general point about how we don't rebut, we demand something be expunged.
It was funny because we had so many candidates for this particular section. We went with the Rebecca Tuvel retraction story because it was definitely one of the strangest dynamics we saw, in which. And we even compared it to, and I was hesitant to use this term until John explained what he meant by it, witch hunts. And by that, we mean Emile Durkheim's sort of definition of like what a witch hunt looks like. And one of the phenomena in the Hypatia situation with Rebecca Tuvel's article was that people were signing mass denunciations of her and then writing her in private and saying, "I'm really sorry what's happening to you." Which shows like a sort of not to over exaggerate, but the kind of nightmarish sort of social situation where people feel like I simply had to sign the denunciation, but I'm so sorry about what's happening to you. And so the whole dynamic around it was really more people acting as like you've crossed into territory that's blasphemous, and therefore we must shut you up. without really any, while making, of course, fancy sounding arguments, mostly just saying like, we're deeply uncomfortable with this argument has to go away. And we've seen this repeated. There was a case with a guy who really as a thought experiment did sort of like a, and this was risky, of course, but did a pro-colonialism article pointing out, you know, that colonialism might have had some benefits for countries. That got retracted after there were threats of violence against both the editor and the author. So, and all of this was happening in relatively close proximity. And it's amazing that you have to remind people. It's kind of like, yeah, if you think something was a terrible journal article, then explain it. don't demand to be scrubbed from existence.
And this my question, Greg. Why, when they went after Tuval, the author of The Hypatia, or I think it was Bruce Gilley at Portland-Stead, who did the colonialism essay, why didn't his colleagues, why don't most academics stand up and say, I demand that this be removed, I demand that this person be censured in some way. Why didn't they stand up and say, get out of here, we're academics, prove him wrong, and then we'll move on?
Yeah, as far as one of the great disappointments of my career, and FIRE, my organization that defends free speech on campus, is celebrating its 20th anniversary this year. I came in, pretty positive about tenure, as a way of sort of increasing the confidence of scholars to be able to follow truth where it leads, no matter what the cost, because they can't be fired for it. And you would think that having the most secure jobs, possibly on the planet, would embolden professors to stand up not just for themselves, but to stand up for their students or stand up for their fellow professors. And while there are absolutely, of course, shining examples of professors who do that, the number is tiny. And time again, when there have been cases, really outrageous cases of professors getting in trouble or students getting in trouble, it's very rare that professors in any meaningful number stand up and say, stop it. This is not the way we solve intellectual issues. This is not what we do when people express an opinion we dislike. That's been one of the truly great disappointments of my career.
You know, I just read a book by Anthony Kroenman. He's great. He's great. It's very good. But I actually he's protesting some of the things that went on in Yale in the last few years. But you tell me if this is unfair for me to say, Dean Kroenman, former Dean Kroenman, why didn't you organize a bunch of professors at Yale, walk in to the president's office and say, hey, knock this off. You've got to stop this. I mean, it's a brave book. But I mean, on the ground, we've got the student protesters. They're very strong. They're forceful. They're powerful. But
well, as you probably know, I was pretty connected to the Yale stuff. I was actually the person who videotaped the student shouting at Nicholas Christakis. And Nicholas Christakis and Erica Christakis, by the way, are essentially saints. They are two of the most decent, most compassionate, most giving people I've met in my life. And they and Nicholas did with that in that famous confrontation in Solomon Square, he actually did that. He stood up in front of angry students and he argued with them in a way that showed bravery and composure unlike I've ever seen in my life. Now, you would like the professors to come out to defend him, but the really horrifying thing, Mark, is that dozens of professors condemned Nicholas Christakis and Erica Christakis. And interestingly, and this does say something about what fields are a little bit more inoculated from this than others, is that there was a group letter saying, defend the Christakises, this is unacceptable, but it was overwhelmingly people from psychology and the hard sciences.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay, thanks a lot, humanities professors. Now, in our last few minutes, Greg, I want to bring up something that's an important part of the book and important to you. And it gets to something of a way out. I mean, at the end of the book has some very concrete recommendations that all school leaders should heed. But also the offering of, because you talked about the psychological, emotional dimension here, about cognitive behavioral therapy, CBT. How might that address some of the when you get into the psychology of fragility and other bad psychologies that we get?
Well, CBT was life-changing for me, and it has been for lots of people. And sometimes I think they should just remove the word therapy from it, because it's as much therapy as, for example, the intellectual practice of Stoics was therapy. Because what it is this ideal of taking your automatic thoughts, which whether most people are aware of or might be faintly aware of the fact that, you know, they have little voices in their head when something goes wrong saying it's like, this is it. It's over for you. You're done for. You know, like when something relatively minor happens, you know, your brain might jump to, she hates me and I'm going to die alone, or these kind of exaggerated thoughts. Interestingly, it turns out that if you get in the habit, and it has to be a habit, it can't just be something you know intellectually, but if you get in the habit of sort of actually looking at those exaggerated ideas of threat or harm or doom, and you deconstruct them and actually say, you know, address them rationally. Like, does this rationally make sense? Once you get in the habit of doing that, and I know from personal experience, a lot of those kind of exaggerated statements, they just kind of lose their force. Now, of course, sometimes I get, you know, people, particularly conservatives, critical of this, saying, well, the problem with this generation is they're over-therapized and you're recommending more therapy. And it's like, but look at the particular therapy. This is actually a way. This is a really profound thing that I've never really gotten over how amazing this is. There's an extremely successful intervention for depression and anxiety, mood disorders, cognitive behavioral therapy, that's essentially just applying rational analysis of yourself.
And you said successful. Isn't the treatment or the recovery, the cure rate much, much higher in CBT than just about anything else out there for these kinds of problems?
There's some evidence that says a lot of different therapies are equally successful. Everything I've read indicates that CBT is more successful than most. And the great thing is, a lot of times they're comparing it to, for example, drug interventions. And of course, drug interventions have all sorts of crazy side effects. Meanwhile, teaching yourself to talk back to your own thoughts. But in terms of the book, the way you sort of talk back to these thoughts is by listing cognitive distortions, by saying, like, is this catastrophizing? Is this overgeneralizing? Is this labeling? And one thing that I really wanted to convey to readers is these are all good tactics for learning how to argue fairly with yourself and internally, but they're also wonderful ideas for how we should argue with each other, which should be taken for granted. But unfortunately, you have to sort of like trick people into realizing that overgeneralizing, for example, that is rampant on campus when it comes particularly to social justice issues, is a cognitive distortion. It's an exaggeration that tends not to be reflective of reality. Things like catastrophizing, all of these things, binary thinking, either you're good or you're evil, as we talk about it. These are good way. They're good. It's good advice for how to talk to your interior dialogue, but also great guide for how do you argue with the person in the classroom with you.
Are you sure that it's better than 12 years of Freudian psychoanalysis?
I can say with strong confidence that it is surely better. Although I will say this, Mark, I make fun of Freud all the time. But I actually vaguely miss Freud at the moment for this one reason. Freud at least had a conception of the human psyche as being kind of a mess, you know, kind of, you know, passions and all sorts of things all over the place.
And he had a tragic sense of that psyche as well.
Right. And meanwhile, the ideology on campus, if you boil it down, it does come back to this sort of oversimplified, you know, evil oppressors versus good oppressed. And it ends up looking like this incredibly simple idea of human nature. And it makes me actually kind of miss the messier conception that actually I think was truer to what we really are.
Right. Let me mention your chapter 2 and chapter 3, because what really gets down to that kind of simplification. Chapter 2 is the untruth of emotional reasoning, : always trust your feelings.
sounds nice for a second after you hear it.
And then chapter 3, the untruth of us versus them. Life is a battle between good people and evil people. And you have a nice commentary on that taken out of Solzhenitsyn that everyone should heed. Anyway, that's all. Let me repeat the book, The Coddling of the American Mind, just out in paperback, How Good Intentions and Bad Ideas Are Setting Up a Generation for Failure. Greg Lukianoff and Jonathan Haidt. It is out with Penguin. Greg, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me, Mark.